Hey guys, I'd like to take the time to thank Phoenix Shooting Bags for sponsoring the show and helping me keep the podcast free. Go check out their website, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you want to purchase anything, just type in John Stallone, all one word, no space in between my name, in the shopping cart coupon area, and you will save 20% on your order. It's pretty sweet. They're awesome bags. If you like shooting and you like long range shooting, they are a must. They've really improved my accuracy and really helped me out with my clients guiding. It's made my life a lot easier helping guys get on deer, and it could do the same for you. So go and check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com, and let's roll into the next episode. Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot and Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that I've been seeing a lot more discussion on it. And I myself, the reason why I even decided to do this topic is because I've been researching it myself. The whole lead bullet versus copper bullet. The whole idea behind pumping meat that you're going to eat full of lead, and how that could possibly affect you. So I've been doing a bunch of research, and I reached out to Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership, and I have Dr. Sean Brodale on with us today to discuss this topic. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, can't complain. Nice day.
Great. Yeah, yeah.
So you're out in Iowa?
I'm in Iowa, yeah.
Nice. How's the weather in Iowa right now?
Weather's great. It's a little overcast, but that's usual for Iowa. Probably 300 days a year, there's clouds. So
it's like I live in Arizona, and it's pretty much 350 days of sunshine.
Yeah, uh-huh.
No clouds. No escape from the sun.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's been crazy. Unseasonably hot.
Yeah.
So, so I have you on today because, this topic keeps coming up, and I haven't really found any definitive answers. I mean,
sure.
I've been asking questions, and I've been looking. I had my own questions, did a lot of research online, and really feel like everybody kind of goes in circles. And hopefully you can shed some light on this subject here.
But, maybe I can help you define the circles a little bit.
There you go. So, before we, jump into the questions that I got for you, why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself?
Okay. So I'm a family practice trained, out here in the rural area. A lot of family practice doc do ER. So that's what I do, full-time ER doc. I got interested in guns, et cetera. Well, first through hunting. Since I came to med school, friends hunted, and we hunt a lot, mostly deer and turkey out here. But after I got out of med school, one of my instructors from med school, as I was talking to him one day, he says, "You need to go get this video series, Bulletproof Mind by Colonel Dave Grossman." And I bought that, took it home, took a look at it, got my wife to watch the first one with me. After that, she was like, whatever. So I watched that, and really changed the way I thought about Second Amendment, about a right to keep and bear arms. I was just kind of laissez-faire about the whole thing. Oh, yeah, people have guns, and, I have a gun here or two. And, didn't really think about our right to keep and bear arms. So I began looking for other people that were like-minded, and I realized that medicine wasn't for guns at all. And
right.
most medical doctors were really against it. And I was like, man, I have got to find some doctors that are for this. And I ran across DRGO on the internet and had some email conversations with the founder, Dr. Tim Wheeler. And we kind of talked back and forth. Then came 2014 Gun Rights Policy Conference that's put on by the Second Amendment Foundation. I listened to that. It was in Chicago. I couldn't make it up there. Listened to that and heard a guy, a doctor named John Edeen, and he was talking about being part of DRGO, et cetera. So I called him up, or I emailed Tim and said, "Hey, who's this guy, John Edeen?" And he says, "Oh, here, I'll give you his number or give him a call." I called John, and they were just great. So the next year, I went to a gun rights policy conference down in Phoenix, Arizona, and got hooked up with them. And I said, "Hey, what can I do to help you guys? I want to be involved." And they said, "Yeah, come on and let's do something." So since then, I've been with them to gun rights policy conference every year. We speak, we try to spread the word, and I've done a few articles on their blog post, and done some things like this podcast. I did an AMA on Reddit, stuff like that, and just really trying to, get the word out about gun rights, et cetera. I tried to get my hospital to change its policy about the no gun zone in the hospital. That didn't go anywhere. They
No.
I tried though, I tried. and in that I became well known in my county and the surrounding counties as the gun doctor, or one guy says, "Well, since you're the gunslinger,"
Nice.
so that's where I come from, and yeah, here I am.
Well, cool. Yeah, I it's you know it's funny that you said that, 'cause I have a lot of my clients, like my guiding clients or doctors, and I have a lot of friends, and it seems to be they're mostly surgeons. A lot of surgeons are bow hunters. I found that a lot of surgeons are bow hunters, and I
And we
it's
find, yeah, we find as we look at that, the surgical specialties are more towards guns and for guns, and more of the academic or clinic specialties are less so. In ER right now, the last thing I saw, it was about 50-50 in ER docs. So.
That's crazy. It must be like a personality type, you know?
The the surgeons have a little bit more ego. They want to be
God
a little more
complex.
independent. They're probably the more testosterone
Maybe that's what it is.
guys, something like that. But there are those who like guns in all specialties. It's just some that are way
Of course.
outnumbered.
Of course. Well, cool. So I have you on today, obviously, to talk about lead and gaming, really. So like I said earlier, I've looked everywhere for information. I keep getting contradiction on what's so I got this term a lot. It's the blood lead levels, and looked at a number of different studies. Read that how I found you guys. I read one of the articles on your website, on that on the DRGO website, and there was also several studies cited in that, and they all had different, what's a safe
What's a safe
BLL,
level?
blood lead level.
So I think that, the biggest thing about that is, maybe the more appropriate questions are, what are the best lead levels? Lead really doesn't have a necessary role in human bloodstream, so it doesn't need to be there. But does that really mean that that even low levels are dangerous? And I think that's the question. Is it okay if we have a little bit of lead running around, or is it dangerous? The CDC a few years ago changed from their level of concern, which was the 10 micrograms per deciliter, to a reference level. And when they did that, they dropped it to the 5 micrograms per deciliter and said that no level of lead is considered safe.
Right.
And it really kind of shows the way the CDC, the way the CDC is. Mm-hmm. So first thing, you know, what's the difference between their level of concern level and a reference level? A reference level really is something that it's totally different than that level of concern. The level of concern says above this level, we really are concerned that things might start happening and we need to address that. And that speaks to it exactly. The reference level is nothing but a lab value.
Right.
It says, just like every other lab value, they take the normals, they take, you know, so many people in the population, they test them, and the people that are considered normal or don't have any symptoms, they say, okay, you know, the majority of these people fit in this, in these levels, and we'll call that the reference levels.
Right.
So they did the same thing with lead. They said, okay, we're testing all these kids, and they waited to do it until the reference levels got down low enough that they could say, oh, we need to change our levels. Because the reference, the levels of lead in children, and by the way, this isn't for everybody, even though they put it out there for everybody, the reference level they use is between 1 and 5 years old. Because,
okay.
Because those kids are getting tested on a regular basis because of their recommendations to test every kid at a year, 18 months, 2 years. And when I was in a clinic in family practice, I was testing, you know, all those kids like that, and really rarely found a kid that had lead. I think in my 12 years, I think I found 2 kids with elevated levels, and they weren't very elevated at all. You know,
right.
They were 12 or 15. And so maybe I just live in a, you know, a very low risk area or something. I don't know. But to show you, you know, where do they go with this? They take that whole group of kids and then they narrow it down to this small, tiny little group of kids that have an elevated level. And then they say, okay, you know, the top 2.5% of kids' blood levels, we're going to make that the reference level. It has no reference to whether those kids have any illnesses, has no reference whether those kids have any problems from having that lead level, has no reference to any of that. It's just how many kids have this. And so that starts the whole process out on a bad foot.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and I feel like that's kind of the way the CDC does a lot of stuff, especially what they've done with gun violence and things like that. They establish these things in the way they want to, you know, that they work it so that it looks the way they want it to look. And
much
so,
like any statistician.
Yes. Yes. You know, the old adage, was, let's see, there's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics.
Right.
You know, you can make statistics say whatever you want if that's what you want to do. If
right.
you're really out looking for the truth in, you know, what is the truth in this science, then, you know, you're looking for the truth. But so many people want to prove their theory true because negative studies don't get published.
Right.
So if you don't prove what you're looking for, then you don't get published and you're not good enough. So I think that if we look back at that reference level or the area, the level of concern level, which was 10 micrograms per deciliter, that's kind of the reference, the level that we should be looking at. And again, just what it says, level of concern, because when the CDC made these changes, they didn't change the level, which is 45 micrograms. They didn't change that level of when you should be treating. So they didn't change anything on what medically needs treatment.
Got it.
They only changed stuff on what we should be looking at and when we should be doing something. When I was in practice, And this first came out when I was doing family practice. I had a kid who had a level which was, I don't know, 8 or 9. And the new thing had come out that we should do something at this 5 microgram level. And I, you know, called my state health department and said, you know, we need this kid look. And they said, no, it's not over 10. And I said, well, but the CDC says, you know, now it's down to 5. And they said, we don't care. Oh. And I was like, okay. And so, you know, still that level remains because it's really the level that has some science behind it. The new lower level, the science is iffy. There's a few studies that say that there can be some damage, some IQ lowering, some behavioral things in kids, and then, you know, high blood pressure and stuff like that for adults. But there's others that say they don't. And so that lead level at 10 really has been set out pretty well, and there's pretty good evidence for it. So it seems like that's probably the better level to look at and say, okay, you know, that we should, again, have some concern for, but still isn't super dangerous, but we should look for, you know, if our kid comes back with that level, yeah, we should look for how are they getting in contact with this lead. And as a parent who hunts and maybe reloads and all that stuff, and how am I,
right.
How am I involved in this, and what can I do to keep it away from my kid if it's that high?
Right. Right. So that kind of leads me in my next question was really is, again, got mixed reviews. Is there any real evidence that supports that consuming game meat shot that's been handled properly, I should say, let me give that caveat, that's been handled. I mean, obviously you're not going to chew on some meat that was where the bullet entered, you know?
Right.
I know it's hard to say because there's so many different bullets and they all designed to fragment differently. They're all designed to, you know, expand them differently or whatever. And
Right. And that is part of the problem with research is, especially medical research, is they want to define everything and they want to narrow everything down to a tiny little corridor of this group of people and this kind of bullet and this, that, and the other. And they never want to look at the whole population because that's too difficult because the population is very homogeneous and there's so many different ways to look at it. And so what happens with the research that you see out there now is, you know, everyone takes a different look at it. And if they narrow everything down to that tiny little pocket, sure, they can find that those people in their study had this, that, or the other, or higher blood lead levels when they ate X amount of meat per day. The problem with that is that the studies also, like I think the Norway study that was in the article, they actually showed that even though in the study they showed that those who ate more meat had some higher lead levels, they also showed that those who were reloaders had the higher lead levels, and those two things went right along together. So did it have anything to do with the meat that they ate? Probably not. They're probably coming into contact with lead and everything while they're reloading a heck of a lot more than what they're eating.
Just from handling the lead?
Just from handling the lead and, you know, having it all over. It does absorb through skin if you let it sit there long enough, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing is, just on that subject, if you're reloading, you're doing something with your ammo or bullets, whichever, however you're doing all that, and then you go and eat, you've deposited some lead on the food that you eat,
and then it
really gets absorbed fairly well there. But so part of that, the Norwegian study showed that over the years, lead levels went down on these same people who are consuming a large amount of meat that was killed with lead bullets and that had lead levels that were high in the first place. Now, lead isn't the easiest thing to get out of your body.
What do you got to do, and, like chelation or something?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And your body will get rid of it little by little, but it's very slow. And so if that correlation was actually correct, and that comes down, again, to correlation or causation, did really that meat that they were eating cause their high lead levels, or was it something else? Was it their reloading? Was it something else in their environment?
Lead pipes, whatever.
Right, lead pipes, whatever. Yeah. Was that really the cause of their elevated lead levels? Well, in that study, over years and years, decades, their lead levels went down. Well, did they stop eating the meat that they were shooting? Well, probably not. You know, their level of consuming that meat that had been killed with lead bullets, it was probably pretty consistent, or even increase over the years because they're getting used to it. They use it more, et cetera.
Becoming better hunters.
Yes, becoming better hunters. Exactly. And so for their lead levels to go down just shows that it probably wasn't the real cause in the first place.
Right.
It had nothing to do with the meat they were eating. So, you know, other things about that, you know, when you look at all the different countries, looking at Canada, looking at the UK, looking at, let's see, there was Australia, there was Norway. You know, most of them, when they look at, you know, you getting lead in food, the animals are actually not even really on the list. You know, first things comes seasonings and herbs and leafy greens like that. Second is salt.
Okay.
So when they say in adults, high lead levels are correlated with high blood pressure and kidney failure, but so is salt correlated with high blood pressure and then kidney failure. So was it the lead or was it just the salt?
Right.
You know, so these people are eating a lot of salt and thus they get some elevated lead levels and it goes like that. So, the fact that you mentioned, you know, processing the meat, right. You know, I don't know about you, but I don't want that destroyed meat that my bullet has gone through.
No.
And, you know, in some of these studies, I think, again, it was either Norwegian or the Australian study. You know, the biggest thing was in chopped meat or basically hamburger. Well, you know, what do they do at the end? They take all that stuff that they've taken out. Maybe they're throwing some of that stuff that came from the bullet cavity. And really what they have to be more careful of is don't put that stuff back in the hamburger. I don't need the hamburger that bad.
No, right?
You know, and so some of it can be preparation, I think. But I think from what I've seen, the risk really is low. And the studies that are out there, they're barely showing a correlation, maybe half of them. And the half that do show a correlation, it's not a great correlation. You know, there's confounding things like that. There's holes in their data. All of those things really make it hard to say, yeah, this is the reason why their lead levels are up. There's other reasons.
Got it. Well, I'm kind of always been on the – I've always erred on the side of, I guess, caution or, you know – I'm a bit of an extremist, but even though there's no real solid evidence, I kind of just try to be, I guess as precautious as possible, you know, and just kind of really, what are some of the things a guy can do, you know, after, let's say, shoots a deer, whatever, and excavating out the wound channel or what, like what, you know, what can you do to kind of avoid some of that exposure?
Sure. I think the biggest thing is, you know, you've got a dead animal. Mm-hmm. So number one, it's not going to spread far. You know, it's not going to soak up into that meat and make its way around the body like it would with a live animal.
Right.
So number one is any damaged meat just throw it out. Don't throw it over there and try to pick through it and say, oh, this looks halfway good. You know, don't throw it to the dogs either, you know.
Right.
but just remove that meat that's in that, that you can see damage, just get rid of it. Most of the time you're going to see the damage that bullet made. There may be some small fragments sometimes around about, but I doubt those small fragments are going to make a big difference in any one person's life, you know.
Right.
Unless you're shooting and eating it, and you got those little small, you've got a bullet that fragments really, really a lot and makes a lot of small fragments. That's going to be rare. It's going to be rare. So yeah, number one is just looking at that. Where did it go through? You know, it took out these two ribs. Take those two ribs completely out. Take the ribs next to them if you're worried about, you know, what right. the meat looks like at all. But I think just paying attention. And that, you know, if you do it yourself, whoever you might take it to, your processor, you know, talk to them about it. Are they careful about that? Or do they just say, oh, we just throw that in with the burger, you know, or the sausage or, you know, whatever, you're making it into jerky, whatever kind of things they're going to do with those leftovers. And just say, hey, could you just, you know, take out that wound channel and don't use that stuff that looks. Don't try to skimp on it. Don't try to get as much out of it as you can. I know, you know, they're going to get paid by the pound, but
right.
it couldn't be that much difference, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, agreed. Are there some bullets? I mean, you're a doctor, not a ballistics expert, but I'm going to ask you this. Are there some bullets that you feel like are better than others as far as, you know, that are still lead? Is it like a copper jacketed stuff? Is that contain the lead a little bit more, or
really the best thing you can do is get something that has that good weight retention.
Okay.
You know, a good weight retention to the end says you've got all that lead in one spot and you don't have a lot falling off in pieces or whatever. If you've got something that just completely fragments and goes 10 different directions, then you've got a lot more to worry about. So a bullet that really has a good weight retention and sticks together, that's going to be your best bet. And, you know, I've seen some jacketed ones that'll do that show that. And most of them, you know, you can find that information because that's a big deal. You know, your weight retention is a big deal on your bullets, and you're going to be able to see that and compare that bullet to bullet.
Yeah, no, that's huge.
The other thing I was going to say there, that we can all do, number one, is shot placement.
Yeah.
You know, if you butt shot a deer, and your whole hindquarter's gone, you know, don't try to use that meat. So,
right.
So your shot placement can be number one too. You get a good heart lung shot and you're going to retain a lot of your meat. And again, you know, you don't have to worry about skimp trying to figure out what do you use, what don't you use, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. For the last few years, I've been going for that high shoulder shot, but yeah, then you lose that whole,
right.
You lose that whole leg. And sometimes the other side, you know,
yes,
I shoot a 300 Remington Ultra Mag. So it's kind of a,
it's going to go through.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I know you started to touch on this. What are some of the effects of high lead levels other than the high blood pressure? Like I've heard, you know, like dementia. I've heard, you know,
I haven't seen a real good link to dementia at all. You know, nowadays that seems to be the thing that everybody's looking for is what is it that's causing dementia?
Okay.
What can we do to avoid it? We can't treat it. You know, the medications that we have to treat Alzheimer's and other dementias help them get better for 6 months, maybe a year if you're lucky. And then
right.
they're decline right down to the point that they were and continue to decline. So you can't cure it. You can hardly even treat it. So everybody's looking at prevention. And so, of course, because we do have some evidence of both behavioral and IQ stuff in children above that 10 deciliter per or 10 micrograms per deciliter level in kids, then they're going to look in the same place. You know, yeah. They're going to go, oh, well, so if it can get to kids while their nerves are developing, maybe it can get to adults too. And mm-hmm. so they're going to push that and look for that. But I don't think that the evidence, unless it's a really high level, but that's more lead poisoning than just having a high blood level. So I don't see dementia as an issue. Certainly the ones that have been shown kids, IQ and just neurologic development, when they're young, that 1 to 5, even maybe up to age 8 or 10, that really has been shown again at the upper levels. Acutely, I mean, if you get really high levels, certainly it can shut down a lot of organs, cause other things, you know, on a short-term basis. But I think the long-term basis is kind of what we're all looking at. There isn't the great evidence in the adult, except when the levels get really high. So again, we're talking, do we have evidence above the 10 micrograms? Sure, there's some evidence. Not so much in adults. Still, most of the evidence is in kids, and most of the evidence to adults is really kind of iffy. And you've got articles, you know, both ways saying, no, there isn't any. Yes, there is some. Mm-hmm. In these lower levels, which is, you know, what the CDC talks about. You know, in one of my classes, NRA instructor course, one of the guys said, yeah, my lead level runs, you know, 26, 28 all the time. And he was just pretty nonchalant. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty high. And I would be, you know, doing everything I could. Obviously, you know, he's a regular instructor. He's coming into contact with lead, you know, every single day, at least three, mm-hmm. four times a week, you know, and something probably should be done there. But he still seems pretty intelligent and led the class pretty well. So outwardly, I could not see any trouble right. with his higher lead levels that he says he's had for years. You know, those are the things that the biggest things are with kids, the higher levels, brain development, IQ, stuff like that. Those are the ones that are really well documented, well researched.
Right. That's probably why I'm so stupid. I honestly, like, I remember as a kid, fishing.
Yeah.
And you know the crimp-on style sinkers?
Putting that in your mouth and biting it closed? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've also remember keeping them inside my mouth for, you know, for whatever reason, you know, to hold on to them for a little bit. I mean, not for like hours on end, but.
No. But just like you stick a nail in your mouth when you're hammering something in, grab it.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
just like
you know.
That. Yeah. Yep.
And
yeah.
I did that. So when I was a kid, I fished a lot. I don't fish mm-hmm. at all anymore, but I fished a lot when I was a kid. I lived on Long Island. That was part of the reason.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, you know, playing with the lead because it's soft and heavy and, you know, just like trying to smash it. And yeah, man, I played with lead when I was a kid. I think about it.
Well, you know,
yeah, that's kind of scary.
Back a few years ago, you know, it's kind of scary now when we think about that, but, you know, we lived through it, you know?
Yeah.
I remember getting mercury out of the thermostat, you know, when we remodeled our house and playing with that mercury. And they're like, oh, that's deadly. And I'm like, I played with it all the time when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and that's even, you know, one of those worst things. That'll kill you. So, we lived through those things. The beautiful thing is the human body really is good at overcoming a lot of this stuff. And that may be part of the reason why they have such a hard time tying it down, because some people's bodies are real good at overcoming this stuff. And other people, you know, they can't quite get rid of this stuff. And some of that can be just plain a human difference, where some people really are susceptible to lead at a lower level, but most people aren't. And, you know, it could be part of it as well.
So what are some good alternatives, you know, if a guy wants to be really, you know, precautious, wants to really... I know there's copper bullets, but...
Right. You know, there are a lot of lead-free bullets out on the market. They are more expensive. You know, I saw one, looked at one article trying to see exactly what the other side was saying. And there was this one article talked about, there are so many lead-free alternatives. I don't know why we don't just ban lead, and on and on. And the funny thing is, there's a lot of alternatives, but they're really expensive, and they're certainly not at the level of you want to plink with or you want to practice with. Yes, they're at the level of, you know, your match grade ammunition and stuff like that. Sure, if you want to use that lead for the actual hunt or stuff like that. But he, in his article, he price checked all of these at Cabela's. Now there's a low price store for you, right?
Yeah.
And so there's where he price checked it. And then he only compared the non-lead ammo with that company's equal ammo, which is their premium ammo, and said, oh, they're all about the same price. And it's like, okay, yeah. So yes, there's alternatives, but... For the everyday person, that can be hard. That can really be hard, because when you're up at, you know, double, maybe sometimes triple the usual price of your range ammo,
right?
And you're going to use that every day, people just can't, you know, they can't afford that. And then that reduces their ability to practice and stay good at what they do. And if they're not practicing, they're not going to keep, you know, they're not going to keep shooting if it, you know, costs them $100 every time they go to the range.
Right.
And so I looked out there. I use a lot of Hornady. So I just popped on Hornady's website and looked. I know that their GMX projectiles are non-lead. And so I just pulled up rifle ammunition and hit non-lead. There were about 50-something options there, and that was over 26 rifle calibers. So that's quite a selection. You know, that's quite a selection.
And that's one brand.
Right. That's only one manufacturer. You know, there's some of the new stuff. Have you
seen? I know Barnes makes a pretty good one, I've heard.
Yeah. The new ARX bullets. Let's see. Ruger has a Ruger ARX that's made for them. And then there's a Novex, N-O-V-X, that's both stainless steel case and it's a copper composite kind of bullet. You know, those are the first ones that I've ever seen kind of outside of the realm of, hey, we're lead free.
Yeah.
You know, that it is being marketed as, we're a totally different thing. Oh, and by the way, we're lead free too.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that kind of caught my attention a few years ago, just because it was a totally different bullet. The ARX is kind of a fluted bullet. It's really weird. It looks like a fan blade almost on the end.
Okay.
And the different ballistics with that, all that kind of stuff. Made it real interesting, and really is what got me interested in, you know, lead or not lead. To me, bullets were lead and it didn't matter, you know?
Right.
But looking at that, you know, I've started using some of those. They have really less recoil. There's some questions about barriers and how much penetration do they have on some of the harder barriers, soft barriers they seem to go through. But again, they're not cheap. You know, it's not your cheap practice ammo. And that really makes it an issue to the majority of shooters. You know, I can spend a little bit more on ammo, I make a good wage, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
Nobody wants to spend more money.
Yeah.
Even if they got it to spend.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I got to say, I mean, I'm on the, and I'm not a rich man by any means, but I really don't like the price point really doesn't matter to me so much. One, I don't shoot enough. I mean, I'm not going to go out and shoot through three boxes of 300 rum. It's just not going to, I'm not going to do
Right.
that. I'm not going to go to,
Right.
if I go to the range and I shoot five bullets just to make sure my gun is on and whatever, I practice a few times. That's a big day, you know? My main concern with the non-lead alternatives is performance, and is it going to burn out my, you know, $1,500 barrel? You know, I
Right.
like those are the things that really concern me.
Right. And I have seen some reviews on that. And it from what they said, you know, these are reviews from these are the manufacturers, these are early reviews with these things that say, you know, the barrel comes out real clean, that things are actually better with some of these like the copper composite and other copper type, you know, most of them are based on copper somewhere along the way.
Which is poisonous to humans anyway.
Right. I mean, yeah, you probably don't have as much trouble as with lead. I don't know why,
No,
but
because
you know,
I mean, you could take copper supplements, like you want copper in small
right.
doses,
As
obviously,
a,
but
yeah, small, yeah, micronutrients.
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so you're like we say in medicine, sometimes you're trading one disease for the other.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the treatment is as much a disease as the disease is, but you know, it's a little better. So yeah, it's hard to say. Certainly I don't want the government getting interested in it. I don't want the government saying, oh yeah, you just have to go lead free. And not let the market take care of that. There, like I said, with some of these new bullets, the market seems to be going that way. I don't know if they went that way because of being lead free and places that, you know, require that. And I certainly hate to admit that because I don't want the government to think that if they require it, then we're just going to do what they want us to do. That's not that's not the way it works. So. Yeah, there's a lot more out there than there was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. But certainly, you know, I think even if they said, you know, we're going to ban all lead ammo in a year, I don't know that they could ramp up, you know, the production of everything else to try to make up for that. There's just not the ability to do that. So. For those of us that it seems to be a concern, or like you said, you know, I just want to be extra careful. It's out there. It's out there. And the ballistics information that I've compared on Hornady's website, their non-lead bullets really keep up pretty well. They have a good coefficient, and they seem to have good terminal ballistics. So they do pretty well, and I've used their let's see, what was it? Full bore. I use the full bore in my 6.5 Creedmoor just to sight in my new scope, and yeah, they were good. They were good. You know, I was keeping them right in the 10 ring. You know, once I got the scope sighted in, so. You know, they're good. They were, you know, I was hitting less than one MOA at 220 yards. So, you know, they're reaching out there. They're doing well. I don't think, you know, especially these big manufacturers like, you know, Hornady and Barnes and, you know, all of the big manufacturers, they're not going to put out a bullet that doesn't perform well, just because it's non-lead, you know.
Right.
I don't think there's that much call for it. So,
No.
I think there's alternatives. You gotta look at, you know, what's the price for you, and do you really care? Some people don't really care.
Right. Right there. That's what it is. I mean,
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I'm putting this out there so people can think about it and make a decision for themselves. I'm on the
Right.
fence still. I don't know. I don't really shoot enough animals with my gun anyway. I'm mostly a bow hunter. So if I do one or two rifle hunts a year, in my opinion, I'm thinking just be really good about selecting the meat, or not taking meat that has any chance of being contaminated and roll with it, because I didn't spend all this time and money trying to build a long range rifle, and then now I gotta have subpar ammo. I don't know that it will be, but I'm just saying. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Sure, absolutely.
So one last question for you. To find out your BLL, is that a special blood test, or like when you go get your regular blood panel for the year or whatever?
It's a
Does it
special
come
blood
with the,
test.
okay.
Blood tests are very specific, and lead, like say on a regular basis, it's run on kids because they're the ones most at risk.
Right.
But on adults, you would have to ask for that. And it's pretty simple. It's not like most hospitals aren't going to have that ability, and
Oh yeah.
if they don't have that ability, there's going to be a hospital close by that does, because kids are getting it done all the time. So even where I live in rural Iowa, most of the hospitals do it, and if not the one 30 miles up the road in the next county, it does it, and it's back by tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, I
So
mean, they have blood clinics over here that can get you results in 24 hours. Would you suggest, I mean, somebody that, let's say, maybe does a lot of bird hunting, a lot of duck hunting, where, it's a lot more lead per square inch of meat that you're eating, go get this test done, every couple of years or whatever, to see where they're at?
I think if you feel like that it's a concern to you and that you are eating a lot of that meat where you think that, especially like you say, like birds, you got a lot of shot in a small bird, and maybe you're just picking the shot out and using that meat, unlike a deer or something like that where you can just completely avoid that area. I think that it's not a bad idea, it's not a bad idea, but I wouldn't say everybody has to do it, I think if people are concerned, yeah, go get it tested and find out,
Make
just to
sure.
know, just to
Yeah,
make
peace of
sure.
mind.
And yep, just peace of mind.
Cool. Well, awesome. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us, and
Thank you for inviting me.
helping me navigate this topic a little bit.
Sure.
Where can our listeners find out more about you?
I'm on the blog at DRGO. That's Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. Our website is drgo.us. I write occasionally. There's a lot of other doctors and medical professionals. You don't have to be a physician or even a medical professional to be a member of DRGO if you want to support us and help us speak back against the established medical community who doesn't like guns and our right to keep and bear arms. We'd be glad to have you as a member, or just stop by the website to kind of see what we have to say and see. It's not all from a medical perspective. It's from a gun rights and a gun owner's perspective. We do get into some of the medical perspective with white papers. We did a white paper on hearing protection, hearing loss, and the suppressor issue. So there's a white paper on there on that, and other things like that that are, mostly medical, but a lot of it is just your run-of-the-mill gun rights. And we're just doctors that are gun rights
Passionate about it.
activists and just, just regular people.
Cool. Well, thanks, Sean. I appreciate you coming on, and
thank you.
We'll keep in touch.
Thank you.
Thanks.